KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, February 19, 2004, for broadcast at this time. Today's speaker will be Tim Higgins, Senior Director of Client Services for the Gallup Organization. He'll give us an update on Gallup's new facilities in Omaha, what's happening there, and what the plans are for the future. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Chris Allen.
Welcome to the Omaha Press Club. My name is Chris Allen. I am from the University of Nebraska at Omaha Department of Communication, and I had the pleasure of moderating this afternoon's Press Club Forum. At least once a month, the Omaha Press Club, through its education committee, sponsors a forum that we hope is of interest to club members and to the community at large. The forums are open to everyone. You don't have to be a member to attend the noon forums. If you look out that window, you can see the remarkable transformation that the Omaha Riverfront has undergone in the last 3 or 4 years. What was once a pretty dismal drive out to the airport has been transformed. A phoenix is rising, not from the ashes, but from lead-soaked mud, a scrap iron pile, and an oil tank farm. A lot more is planned for that area, apartments and condos and a footbridge. And, you know, if they'd move the footbridge just a little bit, we could link Iowa with Iowa, actually. One of the first commitments to our redevelopment on the riverfront was the Gallup organization. I remember I was actually excited when I heard that Gallup had decided to build in Omaha, and I know lots of people were as well. It's such a well-known name and a company that by every measure is an excellent employer and an excellent community member. People know the Gallup name because of the famous polling that it has conducted for more than 50 years. But Gallup is more than just a poll, and we've invited Tim Higgins to tell us more about the worldwide business of the Gallup organization. Tim is Senior Director of Client Services for the Gallup organization. As part of Gallup's Omaha division, he's responsible for all aspects of major account management, including marketing, communications, client acquisition, project design, proposal management, pricing, and contracting. And in spare time, other things, I guess. He joined Gallup as Director of Marketing in May of 2000. Tim was born and raised in Lincoln. He's a graduate of the University of Nebraska. He and his wife, Gina, who is a 19-year Gallup associate, have 4 children. We've asked Tim to leave some time at the end for questions. If you want to ask something about the Gallup organization, or if you have a really great question that you want to ask for on a poll, we have pencils and paper out there on the tables. We'd ask you to jot your question down, and somebody will come around and pick them up. We'll ask those questions from here at the podium. So this afternoon, please welcome Tim Higgins.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chris. The Gallup organization is blessed to employ some of the finest educators, lecturers, and speakers in the world. Unfortunately, none of them could be here today. But I will do the best I can with some information about Gallup. I am, as you could tell maybe from my introduction, more of a practitioner than a lecturer about what we do. But I know a fair bit about what goes on over in that building that you can see if you look out the window there to the north. A little bit of history. Columnist George Will has said that America was the only country that was ever founded on an idea. And it could be said that the Gallup organization was founded on an idea, or rather two ideas. One of them came from Dr. George Gallup back in the 1930s, and that idea was that if democracy is supposed to be about the will of the people, then somebody ought to find out what that will is. Dr. Gallup was born right over there in Iowa. And he taught journalism at the University of Iowa, wrote and ran the college newspaper, and started to become interested in a new scientific method of gauging the opinion of a large population by surveying a random or scientific sample. Now, that seems pretty normal today to us, but back in the 1930s, that was unheard of. It was cutting-edge stuff. And so he began to experiment with that. In 1934, he predicted the turnout of the congressional elections within one percentage point in Iowa. Then he began in 1935 to publish a newspaper column called America Speaks. Then in 1936 is where he really made his claim to fame. This was the presidential election between Alf Landon and FDR, who became President Roosevelt. And he did a nationwide random sample poll of about 12 or 1,400 people and predicted that Franklin Roosevelt would win the election in November. Now, at the time, there was a publication called the Literary Digest, which I believe is no longer around. But they had a slightly different method. They had people from all over the country write their opinion about who they wanted to see elected president on a postcard and send them in to the Literary Digest, and they tabulated the results, and they predicted that Alf Landon would win the election in November. Now, they had literally, I don't know how many hundred thousand of these postcards, and here's Dr. Gallup with 1,400 poll responses saying, no, you're wrong, Roosevelt's going to win, and people thought he was crazy. They said, how can you gauge the opinion of the entire country based on 1,400 interviews? We still get that question asked today. And don't ask me how, because I don't understand it. But he did, and so he, as it turned out, very accurately predicted the results of the November election in 1936. Roosevelt was elected president, as you know, and the rest is kind of history. So he became very famous very quickly for being really the first public opinion pollster in history. Now, back here in Nebraska, in the 1950s, there was another doctor with another idea. Dr. Don Clifton was a professor of psychology at the University of Nebraska. And he began to ask himself, why is it that the study of psychology is almost entirely consumed with what's wrong with people? And still is. And would it be more important to think about and study what's right about people? So that was his big idea, and that's a huge question, and that led him on 50-plus years of exploration and discovery and learning about talent and building on people's strengths and how you can't change people and what it means to be fulfilled and engaged and lead a positive life. And in 1969, he took the beginnings of those ideas, primarily around identifying talent and selecting more like your best if you run a company, and founded a company in Lincoln called Selection Research Incorporated, SRI, which maybe if you're a lifelong Nebraska resident, you probably remember SRI, or maybe you've heard of SRI. Well, along and maybe in the late 70s, early 80s, Dr. Gallup and Dr. Clifton kind of crossed paths, and we began to do some work with Gallup, and the two companies collaborated on some projects. And then in the late 80s, I think it was 1988, it was made official, and the two companies merged. And having a notion that the name Gallup had slightly better global name recognition than SRI, we abandoned the SRI name and changed over to the Gallup organization, and so we still are today. What do we do really at Gallup? Our core competency, if you put it in a sentence, would be this is what we do. We ask the right questions, accurately and scientifically record the answers, and understand and teach what those answers mean. Our hammer and our nail is really a question and an answer, whether it's public opinion polling or strengths development or selection or customer work or any of those kinds of things. We are the world's greatest question askers. And our mission is to discover the truth and maximize performance. So who we are. We have been studying human nature and behavior for more than 70 years. We employ many of the world's leading scientists in management, economics, psychology, and sociology. Gallup performance management systems help organizations increase customer engagement and maximize employee productivity through measurement, coursework, and strategic advisory services. Don't you love that word? We have about 2,000 to 2,500 full-time professionals around the world. We're on site at client organizations. We're on the web. We have three Gallup University campuses, the nicest of which is right over there on the river, also Washington, D.C., and Irvine, California, and 38 offices around the world. And we're much more than a polling company. About 1% of our overall revenue comes from our public opinion polling work, which comes as a surprise to people sometimes. We are very proud of that work, and it's one of the highest profile things that we do. Dr. Frank Newport, who's the editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll and resides in Princeton, New Jersey, I believe was on CNN 400 times last year or something. One of my Gallup associates might correct me. But we have a television studio in Princeton, in our offices there, and Dr. Newport does live break-ins anytime there's any kind of breaking news or poll tracking that we do. So he's on CNN more than some of their anchors are. Since it's a presidential election year, you'll probably be seeing a lot of Dr. Newport in the months to come if you watch CNN. We are a research-based performance management company, and by that we mean that everything we do is grounded in scientific research. That was something that Dr. Gallup and Dr. Clifton very much had in common, was that at their core they were researchers and scientists. So we don't have opinions at Gallup. We have research-based recommendations that have data behind them. What we do, again, we measure and analyze human attitudes, opinions, and behaviors. We consult, educate, and develop people within corporate, educational, governmental, and religious organizations. These concepts that we have about talent and about engaging your employees and your customers, they work in for-profit organizations, they work in hospitals, they work in church congregations, they work in government, and they work here in the United States and around the world. And we partner with over 200 clients in the Fortune 1000. That's just here in the United States, and then many, many more around the world. We are also in the publishing business. Since we have all these people doing all this great research, we occasionally feel the need to write a book explaining what we're up to. If you've heard of a book called First Break All the Rules or Now Discover Your Strengths, Follow This Path, those are all Gallup publications. We have a new book just coming out called Animals, Inc. that you'll probably be hearing a lot of that's really, really good, and more books scheduled in the pipeline in years to come. We have a monthly, online management science publication called the Gallup Management Journal that we make available to managers and executives of client and non-client companies that always has a half a dozen real insightful articles out of our labs, case studies of what we're doing with clients around the world. We have another instrument called the Gallup Tuesday Briefing, which is concerned exclusively with the poll. You can have it emailed to you every Tuesday morning, and it gives the week at a glance of what our polling is revealing, and it tracks some of our ongoing measures like presidential approval and those kinds of things. And you can get that right to your desktop every Tuesday morning, and I think something like 90,000 leaders around the world get the Gallup Tuesday Briefing. As I mentioned, we also are responsible for the CNN USA Today Gallup poll. If you read USA Today, we're in there, if not daily, several times a week. Frank Newport is on CNN probably at least once a day. We also do the polling for the People's Choice Awards, which is kind of fun. If you watch the People's Choice and you wonder who the people are or who figures out who the people are, that's us. We do that. Where we are, we're around the world, Australia, Brazil. I won't read all the countries. South America, the Far East, Latin America, and Western Europe primarily. But we've got offices, I believe, 22 countries around the world. And so we are a global company. And these concepts that we talk about, they work in Germany, they work in China, they work in Iceland, they work pretty much everywhere across languages and across cultures. U.S. locations, our best one, of course, is here in Omaha. We're also in D.C., Princeton, New York, Boston, Atlanta, Cleveland, San Francisco, L.A. I won't read them all, but there's 14 or so locations around the United States so that we can be closer to our clients and provide a higher level of service. Obviously, Omaha is the most fun one out of all of those. Okay, a little bit about how this looks like when we implement with a client. We have a conceptual model of how these things work in execution that we call the Gallup Path that our CEO, Jim Clifton, came up with a few years ago. This will be the first time the Gallup Path has ever been done on radio, to my knowledge, by the way. But when we think about what we're trying to do in an organization, what are the outcomes? We're talking about, for shorthand, we'll say stock increase. In a publicly traded company, that's really the yardstick that you want to use. But in a nonprofit, it's about having enough money to perform your mission. If you're a privately held company, it's about increasing the value organization. But at the end of the day, that's what we're all trying to do so that we can, A, remain in existence, and, B, provide opportunities for our associates and to be a corporate citizen in the community. Well, how do you do that? The only way to really increase your stock, and I'm not talking about short-term, what did you do last quarter types of things. We're talking about long-term, organic, sustainable stock increase, is to increase your profits. You know, this country has had it has a problem with profitability. Corporate profitability across the board is declining and has been for 40 years. And there are a lot of reasons that go into that, but companies just can't get the margins that they used to be able to get. So when we talk about driving your stock price by real profit increase, and by real profit we mean not the bookkeeping kind, not the merger and acquisition kind, not divestiture, downsizing or right-sizing or restructuring or any of those kinds of bookkeeping things that companies do sometimes legitimately, sometimes not so legitimately, to enhance their balance sheet. We're talking about actual, real, organic profit growth, profit increase. The only way to do that is to grow, is to sell more of your goods or services and attract more customers. To do that in today's hyper-competitive environment, and this is where Gallup comes in, those first three things are what we call the outcome measures. In order to grow a company, you have to engage your customers, and you have to keep them coming back. You have to make them resistant to price pressure. You have to make them want to tell their friends to do business with you and all of those good kinds of things. And when this is one of the things that we measure and consult with companies on how to improve. And when we talk about engaged customers, we're not just talking about satisfied, and we're not just talking about loyal. We're talking about what we call engagement, which is an emotional attachment. One of the questions in the metric that we use to measure this is, I can't imagine a world without the Omaha Press Club. Now, you might be able to think of some companies that you think people would feel that way about. Does anybody want to throw out a name of a company they think somebody would be so attached to that it would be part of their life and they would identify with it as part of their personality? No? Anyone? Okay. Mutual of Omaha. Good example. Yeah, Mutual. I'm sure there are people that would answer yes to that question for Mutual of Omaha. When you usually think in terms of what some people call cult brands like Harley-Davidson or Starbucks or Southwest Airlines or Apple Computers. I mean, think about Harley. That's one of my favorites. Nobody needs a $20,000 motorcycle. I mean, there's nothing rational about that purchase. What's going on there is some kind of emotional level engagement where you are so identified with that brand that you have to make it part of your life. And if you know anybody that owns a Harley, you know what I'm talking about, or maybe somebody here has one. But there are people that can get just excited about a bank or a grocery store or a dry cleaner that they can about Starbucks or Harley. So you don't have to be a cult brand to create this kind of attachment. But these are the customers that are the most profitable for you as an organization and the ones that you want to try to get more of. And we help companies measure that and then identify how to do more of that. It's interesting. We've been talking about this emotional connection in commerce for quite some time now. Gallup hosts a positive psychology summit every year in D.C. This is something that goes back to Dr. Clifton, and he was actually named the grandfather of positive psychology and the father of strengths psychology in 2002 by the American Psychological Association. So this revolution that he started back in the 50s about let's look at what's right with people has really taken off. Positive psychology is one of the hottest fields in behavioral science right now, and there's researchers all over the world studying this, what it means to have a sense of well-being. What is happiness? What is a fulfilled life? Instead of thinking about dysfunction and depression and things like that. The keynote speaker at our conference last year was a gentleman named Daniel Kahneman, who's a psychologist at Princeton, and he had just won the Nobel Prize. He spoke at our gathering, and he's doing some work with us now. And the interesting thing is that he's a psychologist, but his Nobel Prize was awarded in economics. And it's the first time that a psychologist has ever been awarded the Nobel Prize for economics. And his field of study is emotional elements of human decision-making, especially as it relates to buying decisions in the marketplace. For years, marketers have thought that we're all just kind of computers walking around now, right? We think about how much does it cost? How long does it last? How far away is it? What do I have to do? And we plug all of this data into our minds, and we make a rational decision based on that input like a computer. Well, we're not like that. We're a lot more emotional about things like that. A buying decision is a lot more emotional than it is rational. And he has studied that, and he won a Nobel Prize. So we feel like we're kind of onto something there, too. So we help customers think about how to engage their customers. The single best way we found to do that is to have engaged employees. And so we also spend a tremendous amount of time studying what it means to be engaged in the workplace and how a company's culture and management can help their employees be more engaged, because engaged employees help create that emotional attachment with customers when they react to them. And you all instinctively know what I'm talking about. If you've ever checked into a hotel and the desk clerk was just the nicest, friendliest, most helpful person, it just almost made your day to have an interaction with that person. You're going to think more highly of that hotel, and you're going to go back there if you have a chance to stay there again. On the flip side, if they're not engaged, if they're having a lousy day, that translates to you as a customer. And how does that make you feel? Not only about them as a person, but I don't like that hotel anymore. So there's that human interaction that goes on at that point of commerce where somebody's serving someone or somebody's buying something from someone that really has to be right. And the best way to do that is to engage your employees. The best way to do that is to make sure that they have a great manager. The single biggest determining factor of a person's satisfaction in their job is the quality of their relationship with their immediate supervisor. We have studied this at length, and we find that people go to work for companies. They join brands, they join benefit programs, they join compensation packages. When they leave a manager. And if you think about it, if you work for a large company, your supervisor, your manager, they are the company to you. You don't spend time with the CEO. You don't sit in executive meetings. Your manager, they are the company. And so the quality of that relationship drives your engagement and then on to customers. Now, what else can we do for people besides making sure that they have a great manager to make sure that they're engaged in their job? Well, the first thing we need to do is we need to identify their strengths. Remember I talked before about Don thinking about, let's study what people are good at and help them do more of it. Well, if you're going to position people correctly to do what they do best every day, you need to have some way to find out what that is. We're all good at something. When we talk about talent, or when I say talent, you may think of Tiger Woods or Barbara Streisand or Julia Roberts or famous, you know, sports and entertainment. Those are easy examples because those people are out there and we can see them all. But that world-class front desk person at that hotel, that's a talent. Okay? Everybody can do something better than 10,000 other people. What we want to do is help people figure out what that is and then help them do more of that and quit trying to fix people by trying to figure out what they're not good at, because that's fighting against human nature and you're going to lose, number one. Number two, it's not productive. And number three, it's annoying. It's like when we say you don't teach a pig to sing, you'll annoy the pig and it doesn't work. Well, so this is, a lot of this is common sense, but yet companies around the world spend billions of dollars every year trying to train people to do things that they're not naturally wired to do. And it frustrates the pig. And then you want to put them in there, and once you've identified a person's talent and strengths, you want to put them in the right role. You want to put them in a job that lets them do what they do best every day. Right fit to me is nothing more than Michael Jordan as a basketball player or Michael Jordan as a baseball player. Same guy, different job, slightly different outcome. Okay, Michael Jordan was miscast as a baseball player. Michael Jordan was perfectly cast as a basketball player. Well, we're all Michael Jordan at something. And finding out what that is the key to A, being engaged and happy as a person, but B, part of being a productive organization. And we have some tracking data about how this has worked over the years, about how companies we work with are more profitable and generate more net revenue and have better stock prices than the S&P 500. And so that goes back to an earlier point. Everything we do needs to be based on research, and everything we do needs to be measurable and tied to an outcome. If it's not measurable and it doesn't link to some kind of positive business outcome, then we're not interested in it. Okay. The good news is that what's right for people is also what's right for corporations. So it's a win-win. When we think about how we change the world, yes, we want companies to be more profitable. Yes, we want their stock price to be higher. All of those good capitalistic kind of things. Okay. I'm a big fan of capitalism. But by the way, if that company also engages its customers and makes their life better, and if it engages their employees and those people are happier and more engaged, and when they get home, maybe they're nicer to their spouse and they're nicer to their kids and they have more emotional energy to get involved in their community, so they volunteer at school or the church. I mean, you can see there's a ripple effect here that this really can create a world of difference. So really all we're trying to do is change the world. And we do a little bit every day. Sometimes on a really good day, we change it a lot. Last August, we did the first post-Iraq invasion poll of the people of Baghdad. And I don't know if you happen to catch any of this. It was in the news for a while. The genesis of this was actually a year and a half earlier. We did a poll of the poll of the Muslim world in between 9/11 and the beginning of the Iraq War. So it was about a year and a half ago. And we did extensive polling in 9 Muslim countries. We were asked to brief the White House on the results. We would by no means take credit for changing or even affecting policy, but I think that did give people a reason to think about that part of the world in a new way, and here's why. Prior to the poll, I think the general consensus may have been that, you know, the people in those countries over there, the Muslim world, they're not necessarily angry or dissatisfied with the United States. The people that we have a problem with are kind of a small radical faction. They're a minority. And yeah, they're causing problems, but by and large, the person on the Arab street over there thinks we're kind of okay. Well, actually, our poll uncovered the fact that they pretty much all don't like us. And it went all the way from, you know, any age, demographic thing you wanted to look at, education, they just have very serious problems with the United States as a group. And I don't mean to generalize, but without breaking down country by country, there are countries where over 30% of the people thought we did 9/11 to ourselves. There are countries, I think across all 9 countries, it was about 34% of the people thought that we got what we deserved on 9/11. Now, that's a third, that's not a majority, but that's a pretty high number, and that's pretty scary if you think about that many, I don't know how many billion people this represented. So I think it's maybe a bigger problem than what we thought it was before, that we're not just dealing with a few, you know, fringe people. So anyway, after that being such a great success, we decided that we needed to go to Baghdad and see what those folks were thinking after hostilities ceased over there. So with the cooperation of the State Department and the Provisional Authority and Ambassador Bremer, we had people over in Baghdad. We interviewed 1,178 citizens of that city in a random sample poll. It was in person. Their telephone infrastructure is not as advanced as ours is, so it made that a little bit dicey. So it was in person, kind of like the way Dr. Gallup used to do it back in the 30s and 40s, only without the mortar fire. And here are some of the things that we found out. Residents of Iraq's capital of Baghdad say by a 2-to-1 margin that the ousting of Saddam Hussein was worth any hardships that they might have suffered as a result of it. It's actually 62%. 30% of the people said no, it wasn't worth it. In your opinion, is Iraq much better off, somewhat better off, somewhat worse off, or much worse off than before the U.S. and British invasion? A third say they are already much better off. Now, this is in August. The war had just ended. It will be very interesting to go back and do this again, and I believe we will. I don't know exactly when. But you would expect those numbers to get increased over time. These people, they still didn't have a power grid or any you know, their services hadn't even been restored. You know, now hospitals and schools are open and the water's running and all that kind of stuff. This is right after it ended. And a third said they were much better off than they were before the invasion. And actually 32% said that they were worse off than before. So that's a little more ambivalent. You would expect maybe to see some movement in those if we do it again in 6 months or something, because situations are improving. This is an interesting one. In your opinion, why did the United States and Great Britain decide to invade Iraq? Anybody want to take a guess what the number one answer was? Oil. Yeah. 43% of the people said it was to rob Iraq's oil. And they were still happy we did it. The takeaway for me here is that they're happy we came in, but they question our motives. They don't entirely trust us. 37% said, well, to topple Saddam. 15% said some kind of benefit for the U.S. people. These are open-ended questions. We didn't prompt them. We just asked the question, and they just talked. To colonize the Middle East, 14%. And then on down from there, weapons of mass destruction was 4%, according to those guys. Do they think we're serious about establishing democracy in Iraq? 52% of them said yes, they do think we're serious. But only 35% think we'll let them fashion their own political system without U.S. influence. So again, glad you're here, like what you're doing, not really sure about your motives. And that's kind of to be expected. And then one final one, 51% of them agree that the U.S. is very serious about improving the economic lot of Iraqis. So that's more positive. 38% said, no, we don't believe that. So, and there's a lot more to this, and I can tell you how to get copies of it if you like. It's a tremendous study. I believe Richard Burkhalter, the author, has been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, if I'm not mistaken. So, we had one more. In your own words, what do you most resent about the West? Anybody want to take a guess at what the number one one's there? Power. It was the spread of corruption, pornography, and immorality. More than a third, 36% of Baghdad residents say they believe Western culture has undermined moral standards by spreading sexually indecent influences and corruption. One in five, 19%, expressed the belief that Western traditions and cultural norms are totally different from our Islamic ones. And 17% said they resent what they view as the West's excessive freedom and liberality. Now, I don't know what you do about that one. I mean, we can tell them that we're not over there to steal their oil, and we can tell them that we're there to promote democracy and help their economy, but I don't know what you do about that one. Because that's religious. They are not going to believe that Sex and the City is an okay TV show, and we're not going to stop making TV shows like Sex and the City. So we may just have to leave that one hanging out there, because I'm not sure that's fixable. Okay, now to the final one, the final big question, who's going to win in November when Nebraska plays Oklahoma? Actually, I do have some presidential polling data. This is hot off the press. Right now, and this is about a week and a half old, John Kerry's lead in the Democratic primaries appears to be insurmountable. Now, that's not to say that if he gets caught on a yacht with Gary Hart or something like that, that might not turn around. But we saw a steady decline from Howard Dean. Dean was at 31% back in December. He was at 10 about a week and a half ago, and I guess now he's at zero. So Kerry started off very slowly, was tied with Edwards at 10% back in December, and is now at 52 positive approval rating. So he's got miles ahead of anybody else. Of course, now that it's down to a two-man race, that might change, but the chances of Edwards catching up are probably pretty slim, but you never know. So given that, we have been asking the question for a few weeks now about, okay, if the election were held today and it was Bush versus Kerry, who would you vote for? Assuming that Kerry's the more or less the presumptive nominee. Interestingly, for only the second time since 1948, a non-incumbent is leading in this poll. So there's a couple of things going on there. In other words, Kerry, as of February 6th through the 8th, Kerry's got about a one-point lead against Bush. Actually, it's virtually tied. He was ahead by 7 points about a week and a half ago. So it's been fluctuating. But I think Carter was the only other one I read since 48 where an incumbent president was trailing in a horse race question at this time of the year. Now, does that mean Bush isn't going to get reelected? I don't know. One thing is that Kerry seems to have wrapped this up awfully early. This is not normal for there to be a presumptive nominee this early in the process. So it may just be that he's benefited from so much media attention up to this point that he's going to win that, but we'll keep tracking that all the way through. Now, we don't know who's going to win yet, and I couldn't tell you even if we did. But I understand from talking to our poll people that there's a couple of bellwether indicators that are fun to watch if you're a junkie about this kind of thing like I am, and you want to see over the next few months, what can I look at to see what Bush's chances are against whoever the nominee ends up being? There are really two that historically are pretty predictive of what's going to happen in November as we get into the next few months. One of them is presidential job approval rating. Right now it's at about 51%. It's been as high as 90, and it's at about its lowest point in the last, about the last year right now. If Bush's approval rating starts to head south of 50%, that is traditionally a bad indicator for reelection chances of an incumbent. If it stays above 50, that increases his chances of being reelected. So that's one to watch. Right now, as of about a week ago, it's at 51. The other one to watch is a question that we ask that we call the most important problem question. We ask Americans on a weekly basis, what do you think is the most important problem facing the country? Now, the answer is always the economy or some format of the economy. So it's either jobs or we lump them together in economic and non-economic answers. And we don't prompt them. That's an open-ended question. When Carville and Begala told Clinton it's the economy stupid, they were right. It is. It's always the economy stupid. And it has always been as far as presidential politics. But when the total number of people that say the economy is the most important problem facing the country, again, starts to move above that 50% margin, that does not bode well for an incumbent president. People vote their pocketbooks. So regardless of what's going on in Iraq or any place else, people ask that question, am I better off? And that's tied to the economy. If something else moves in front of that or that gets down into the 30s, then the president has a much more likely chance of being reelected, at least historically. So those are two to watch, presidential approval and what's the most important problem facing the country. Right, as of the last time we looked, which I think this data is a couple of days old, when you add them all together, it was at about 48%. So he's at 51% approval, and the economy being the most important problem is at 48%. So it's a coin toss right now, I think. But obviously, there's much more to happen in the next however many months. All right. Thank you very much for your attention. Any questions? Good.
Actually, you've provided me a wonderful segue with your ending, because I have several questions here that deal with political polling. Do you think that constantly publishing polls before the elections make people not want to vote because their candidate isn't doing very well when that happens?
Wow. That would be a great question for Frank Newport. Well, no, because I think it's okay that people understand what the landscape is. I mean, it's public information. People have a right to know what's going on out there, and I don't think it's right to keep that information from people. Our responsibility is to be as accurate as we possibly can. So our integrity is to the data. What people do with that information, I'm sure when Dean started heading south, people started jumping off the bandwagon. I think that's just kind of how it is. And if we didn't do it, somebody else would, and they wouldn't do as good of a job. So.
How'd you do with the Dewey Truman election?
I think we had that one. Did anybody remember? We had that one. We had Truman. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't here then, by the way.
Yeah, I realize that. I want to get away from polling for a moment, because we have a couple of questions about the campus here. Why is it called Gallup University, and can you talk a little bit about what specifically goes on here in Omaha, mm-hmm. in the Omaha office?
You bet. That's a great question. It's our National Operations Center, so the majority of our executives are here, not all. Gallup University is the training and education part of Gallup, so when we talk about helping companies understand their customers better and how to hire for talent and how to be a great manager, We have courses that are built around all those things, leadership, and people can come here from our client companies and spend usually 2.5-3 day learning sessions here at the Gallup University campus. So there we do have classroom settings, and we have people from all over the country here every week to learn and grow and find out how to implement our practices within their own companies. Everybody from CEOs and executives to managers and frontline supervisors, teachers, school principals, school district, head, you know, people, nurses, doctors. I mean, we touch a lot of different industries, but we make that learning available on the web and on site at clients. But sometimes clients want to come to us for a learning experience, and that's what we do here at Gallup University. And there's also a location where we do that training in Washington, D.C., and in Irvine, California.
Well, I have a million questions here. There's a whole bunch. I hope we can get through the majority of these. Who's Gallup's best customer?
Gosh, I don't know if I can say. That you know, that's a hard one. I'd rather not identify anybody by name. We have we're pretty conservative about identifying our clients. We have many, many very high profile customers whose names that you would instantly recognize that are very high profile companies. But unless they're published, we don't really broadcast our association with them. I guess one that I might mention would be Toyota. That's a company that everyone's heard of. They've been very public about their association with us. Mike Morrison, the dean of Toyota University, is a huge fan and has written liner notes on at least one of our books that are aware of. So we've got a great partnership with Toyota. They're one of the best companies in the world at what they do, as you know, and we do a lot of great work with them. So we have a lot that are our favorites. There are probably some that are bigger than that and probably some I can't mention, but that's an example of the kind of people that we work with.
There's a question that's been nagging me. What was it about Omaha that brought you here? It seems warmer in Irvine.
Well, we moved from Lincoln. We have offices all over the country, but the core group of people that are now here in Omaha, by and large, came from Lincoln. So, you know, Dr. Clifton started SRI in Lincoln. We're a Nebraska company. Even though we're worldwide, we really tried very hard to stay within the state of Nebraska. The city of Omaha did an absolutely fantastic job of putting together what they put together for us. Then Mayor Dobb, who was really totally instrumental in probably the main reason that we're here, had a lot of help. But travel, a lot of things, telecommunications infrastructure, travel arrangements, labor pool, ability to grow. Nothing against Lincoln, but we just felt like we maybe had outgrown it a little bit, and Omaha just was a very attractive place from the people, the local business climate. It's just fantastic. It's been fantastic ever since we've moved here. The people are great, have been so welcoming. I've heard stories of after we moved, Gallup Associates were down in the old market at the Upstream, and people found out they were from Gallup and were buying them drinks. People they didn't even know. I mean, that's the kind of thing that's gone on since we've been here. So it was a variety of things, but Omaha's leadership had an awful lot to do with it.
You use that as a perk when you're recruiting employees, that they can get free drinks down at the Upstream? How are the various public opinion polls paid for? Who pays for them? Like the one you did in the Middle East, the presidential polling, who pays for the various types of public opinion polls?
That is another very good question. We are compensated through by CNN and USA Today for the work that we do that they are the primary media outlet for. We do a lot of it on our own nickel. The poll of the Muslim world and the Baghdad poll we paid for because we just thought it was that important and that we should do it. So we're a little bit different in that we're not really a reporter, but we're kind of our own newsmaker. But we're also kind of our own media company, so a lot of it we pay for ourselves. I'm glad you asked that because it gives me a chance to clear up another misconception that sometimes people have about Gallup. What we do not do is work for individual candidates or parties. So when we do the presidential approval, and as we get closer to the election, we'll have the horse race poll, and just like, you know, Zogby and everybody else, we'll make a call on the eve of the election, but we don't work for President Bush or the RNC or the DNC or... If somebody's running for the governor of Nebraska and they call up and say, can I do a poll, we say no. And we turn away, frankly, probably a significant amount of business over the years. But It is extremely important to us that we maintain our objectivity, and so that when people see something published by the Gallup poll, they know that there's no bias. We have no axe to grind. We are simply reporting the truth. So we don't work for Republicans or Democrats or anybody in between. We work for the American people, I guess you could say.
Along with that, could you talk about how you phrase questions so to reduce the bias in the way the question is asked?
That's another good question. I am not a really qualified person to answer that. As not being a methodologist, Dr. Newport and some very smart people in Princeton that write the poll questions. I know there is a science to it. There are right ways and wrong ways to ask questions, and you can skew data by asking questions incorrectly. I can just tell you that we've got literally dozens of PhD level people that just spend their life writing poll questions. Some of these questions, the presidential approval question, we've been asking the same question for like 50 years. So we've got data going back, to Eisenhower on some of this stuff. But we have people whose job it is to write questions, and they're much smarter than I am.
A little bit to the other aspect of, one of the other aspects of your business. How do you convince companies to spend time and money to create engaged employees? In other words, when a company comes to you and says, we want to improve things, and you tell them that, one of the best ways to do it is to create engaged employees, how do you convince them to get away from the notion that, well, we don't want to spend it that way, we want to do promotions or things? How do you convince them that that's the way to go?
Well, it's sometimes a struggle. What we do is we dollarize the cost of not doing it, or conversely, the return on investment of doing it. We used to think, I think, back in the day, that if you could have two kinds of organizations. You could have one where everybody was really happy and we were like a family and everybody got along and loved their job. But it wasn't the world's most successful place. We weren't setting it on fire. But we all enjoyed each other and we had a good time. Or you could have the kind of company that was really hardcore, hard charging, hard on its people, 90 hours a week, burning people out. But, man, they hit their numbers. Their stock price was up. And that was a successful company. And you either had to pick one of those two paths. Well, what we've learned is that you can do both. What's good for people is good for organizations. So we show companies that, look, if you increase the engagement level of your employees, you will cut your turnover by 20%, and that will save you $250 million. That stuff like that usually gets their attention.
You talk about polling and predicting. Do polls predict, or are they a snapshot?
Wow. I guess I would say more of a snapshot. Now when you on the eve of the presidential election, when we say, here's what's going to happen tomorrow, that's a little bit of a prediction, but it's a short window. It's a 24-hour window. And in that case, you're asking people, how are you going to vote tomorrow? You're asking likely voters. So you're asking people to predict future behavior. And somebody might answer that question one way and then go to the booth the next day and do something totally different or not even show up to vote at all. So I guess there's an element of prediction, but really they're a snapshot of what people's attitudes and opinions are at a point in time, and that's why it's important to continually track those questions over time, because when you can see, for example, Bush's presidential approval, you want to look at months, weeks and months of where that number's moved. One data point in time of where that was at on one specific day really doesn't tell you a whole lot. What you're looking for is it moving up? Is it moving down? Does it have momentum one way or the other? Is it static? So I would say more of a snapshot.
But taken over time, there's a little more legitimacy. I love this question. I'm really glad somebody asked it. What do you think of TV and internet call-in surveys? Do they have any value at all?
They have entertainment value. Well, they do. Anytime you have people self-select and respond voluntarily to a survey, there isn't any science behind it. So when they go on TV and say, go to the internet and vote now for, who you think is the whatever, that's just a function of who's sitting close to their computer and who happens to like who the choices are. And that it's not a representative sample. There's no science behind it. You could get an online internet poll that had 200,000 responses, and it would be less valid than a properly constructed random sample of 600. I mean, the margin of error is so enormous as to make it not even relevant. They're just simply interesting, I guess.
to somebody they are. Talk for a moment when you do polling about the age criteria that you use. Does it vary for, like, I would imagine for if you're doing presidential polling, it would be 18 because that's the voting age. But does it vary for, like, the People's Choice Awards? Do you have different criteria for the age groups that you measure?
That's another good question. Almost everything we do is adults 18 and over. If you interview 16 and 17 year olds, I think you need parental permission. Is that right, Lisa? So, and I want to say that there's an element of the People's Choice maybe where we went down to 16. But that's very rare. All of our national random sample stuff is United States adults 18 and over.
I think you said early in your talk this afternoon that public opinion polling accounts for about 1% of the revenue. With that tiny amount of business, why do you keep doing it?
Well, because it's just so vitally important. I mean, it's one of the founding missions of the company. When Dr. Gallup said, you know, if democracy is about the will of the people, somebody needs to find out what that is. That's our job, and we see ourselves as guardians of that. 75 years later, I don't imagine that we'll ever stop doing it. It's a very high profile part of what we do. It's great name recognition for us, and it contributes to the public good. So it's a very mission driven thing that we do.
Is Gallup likely to do a poll on how many people like or don't like the O logo for Omaha?
Well, the chamber hasn't asked us, so I don't know.
That gives me a chance. Somebody actually asked that question, but I brought it up specifically because the title for the Omaha Press Club show this year is My God, and it will be held April 1st and 2nd at the Rose Theater, and you're all welcome to come out and hear myself and many, many others make fun of everybody who has opened his mouth in the state this year. It's going to be quite a lot of fun. We promised to try to get you out of here at 1 o'clock, and it is almost that. So I'd like to take a moment to have you thank once more Tim Higgins from the Gallup Organization. A couple of things before we leave. For people who are not able to make it here, the noon forums are available on the Internet. They're also available on videotape. If you're interested, you can call CP Media. The number at CP Media is 800-227-5281, or you can contact the Press Club here to call. Thank you all for coming out today. I've enjoyed the program, and I'd like to thank you for coming. I'd like to thank KIOS for broadcasting our program, we are adjourned today. Thank you.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's guest speaker was Tim Higgins, Senior Director of Client Services for the Gallup Organization. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, February 19th, 2004, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Chris Allen for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be Thursday, March 19th at 12 noon. The speaker will be Dr. Lee Simmons, the director of Omaha's Henry Dorley Zoo. His topic will be the Hubbard Gorilla Valley. If you'd like to attend this or other future forums, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.